Originally, when you're designing a transformer, there's a little bit of intuitive gut that's involved, but there's also some math that you can use to get you started. So it's not just a trial and error thing. It's just one of the things that I wanted to point out, that there is actually some math that you can follow to get you where you want to go. It's all right, I'm UKJJ.
Yeah, well done, Eric. So, the guys supplying the magnetic material, if you dig deep enough into their literature, they give you a course on how to do it. There are a number of other websites that will tell you how to do it. I'll warn you, though, you're going to start off kind of confused in the beginning. Do you measure magnetic field in Tesla, Gauss, Weber's per square meter? There's about five different system units that they use just for measuring magnetic field and varying magnetic field and rate of change of rate in magnetic field and so on. So even to compare different articles on the subject, at first it's going to slow you down. And by the way, I think there are 10,000 Gauss per Tesla is one particular conversion factor. Over to you, Bill. W2SAW, K2RAW, the TechNet.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I was kind of hoping you'd say something like the more the merrier, but clearly it's not that. So thank you for throwing some light on that. W2SAW, back to you, Dick.
The more the merrier is close, Bill. If your core is big enough so that you can put more turns on there without using up that space in the hole. In general, more turns is better. The slight disadvantage of more turns is that now the primary winding is longer in length, and if it's not a large enough gauge of wire, you're picking up some extra resistance. But with good design, that tends to be a minor factor. And when it comes to the size of the core, the bigger the core, the better. You're going to get less saturation and more coupling, if you know what I mean. So if you choose a core that is big enough, if you make the number of turns big enough, and if it's the right material that works well at that particular frequency and has a high enough saturation, and by going to the magnetic core manufacturers, the toroid manufacturers, and looking up their data sheets, eventually you'll figure out what's the best one for you. And if you're in doubt as to whether or not that particular core can really tolerate the 500 watts you're going to put through it, then spend a little bit of extra money and buy the 1500 watt core, so to speak, to be double darn sure. It's not rocket science. Once you've built your first toroid and you've ironed out these minor details and you made it work, you'll say, why the hell hasn't somebody told me this earlier? I could have been building various transformers for all of my antennas years ago. Why the hell did I wait this long? You'll say something along those lines when you finally solve the problem, Bill. W2SAW for any final comments. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. I guess I came across this because I use a toroid on my loop antenna. And by trial and error, I just found that five turns from the transmission line onto the toroid, which sits on the loop, which is one turn, seems to work out okay. But I think you've answered my question. Thank you very much. W2SAW.
The earlier question we had tonight about whether or not the 5-to-1 or 10-to-1 transformer was simultaneously supplying isolation is a function of whether or not it is a auto transformer. You can save the number of turns on the primary and secondary if the primary and secondary share some of the turns. So if you've got a winding with a tap in the center, and between tap and one end you call it the primary, and between tap and the other end you call it the secondary, or the whole winding you call it the secondary, that's called an auto transformer. The good news is that it's got a lot less turns of wire required, and it's higher in efficiency. The bad news is there is no isolation between primary and secondary. If you go the next step, and if on that auto transformer the primary had 10 turns and the whole secondary was 50 turns, including the 10 turns of the primary because it's an auto transformer, and you rewind it with a completely separate primary and a completely separate secondary, where you add the extra 10 turns to that secondary winding, and you make the secondary winding uncoupled from the primary. Now you simultaneously got isolation, so that if this is an open transformer you can easily get access to, and if the hole in the middle is big enough, you can take a commercial product that is an auto transformer that's got the right impedance ratio but doesn't have the isolation, and you can give it the isolation. Let me drop it. We amateurs at times are very skilled at taking somebody else's commercial respected piece of hardware and make minor changes to it to suit your particular application. You'd be amazed how many times hams have done that and worked out very successful. And the main thing that we amateurs do is we talk to each other. That's got a huge advantage when it comes to sharing information as to what works and what doesn't work. I mean, when most of us make a QSO to a guy the first time, the first thing we find out is what's the signal strength and what's your name and, where you, and what's your QTH. After that, what kind of a rig you're using? What's your transmitter? What brand name? What model number? What's your transmission line? What's your antenna? How well has it worked? Is it the first antenna you put up? Is it the best one you put up so far? Do you like it? Is that loop antenna giving you all this magic performance that everyone's been telling us about? Let me drop that. We amateurs communicate with each other. When it comes to technical transfer of information, very valuable information, most of the time gets transferred that way. Occasionally you get some old wives' tales. You get people telling you that if you cut the antenna down to 4:1 in size and re-resonate it, you're going to get 1/4 or 1/16 of the area on reception. Lots of guys in 20 meters have attitudes like that. Good common sense. Dead wrong. So you got to be a little bit careful. There's a couple of bad, and you get guys who'll tell you that each UHF connector at 2 meters is going to give you half a dB of loss. Pure bull. There's essentially no loss in a well-manufactured, well-installed connector. It has no length. It has no ability to create loss unless you've made it out of carbon granules, if you know what I mean. So there's a lot of old wives' tales out there. But except for a few of those, we share a lot of information back and forth as to what really works. On top of that, if you're an HF guy, you're quite often talking to somebody in some other country, in some other continent. Let me drop that. And a lot of good human understanding can take place. All of a sudden, a lot of prejudice of various races and religions and whatever can disappear, or at least be highly attenuated. That's the one real problem that the guys who are into radio astronomy have. I've attended a number of the meetings of the National Radio Astronomy Observatory group that meets there every year in June, called SARA, S-A-R-A, Society of Amateur Radio Astronomers. These guys build some beautiful hardware, fantastic antennas, very sensitive receivers. But because they are not ham radio operators in general, you look at 30 SARA members, and 3 of them are hams, talking to each other. The other 27 have no ability to do that. The only talking to each other they do is in the one week meeting they have at Green Bank, West Virginia, at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory. Once per year, they talk to each other. Or they're sending emails back and forth, or calling each other on the phone, and sending letters. We amateurs have a much more advantageous way of talking to each other with the radio equipment we've built. So, when it comes to people sharing information, the organization that shares the information the most of any organization I've ever known is NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Almost everything they do becomes public domain, public knowledge. Let me drop it. The Hubble Space Telescope has been up in the air since roughly 1990. So it's up there for what? 27 years? It has gathered with the thousands of experiments they've done with Hubble. They've gathered thousands of terabytes of data, all public domain. You look at the latest issue of Scientific American magazine, the back cover, the last page. It gives you a graph showing the number of thousands of experiments where all of the data of each of those experiments is in the public domain, and you can study it. You can look at the pictures. You can find other stars and other pulsars and other other Cepheid variables and other 1A supernovas and whatever in that data. And the guy who gives us the most amount of information as to what NASA has done is Paul WS2N with the space report. So here comes space report number 240 of the series. Has NASA been doing anything this week, Paul? I'm having some fun with him. WS2N, K2RIW, the TechNet.
This is WS2N, and they're always doing something. The best information not only comes from NASA, but you team that up now with Wikipedia. And you'd be surprised how accurate Wikipedia is. You know, you bring up a space mission, want to know something about it. Yeah, NASA has it. It's free. Copy the pictures, copy the text if you want. Make articles. No problem. There's no copyright laws. It's great. But with Wikipedia, too, you know, you go over there and you get a quick pieces of information about whatever you're looking up. And then, you know, if you want to go into depth, you go into NASA, and then you go into the PDF files, you know, what's inside that. You can get into, you know, some almost like engineering type of designs that they've gone through. It's all public information. It's great. Back to you, Dick. I'll find a signal before you go on. WS1.
Paul, your signal is very good. Not excellent. It is 95% audio, 5% hiss. Very little hiss in there. There are times when you take your antenna and move it a couple of degrees to the right or to the left and tell me how many degrees you've moved it, and I can tell you when the signal gets stronger, if you want to. You don't have to. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, all right. Just more power. I just went up a little bit. I guess it's not much of a difference, correct?
I didn't hear any difference. In the past, you can make a 10 or 20 dB difference when you aim the antenna a little bit. What's crazy is that most Yagi antennas might be horizontally polarized, and maybe the vertical polarization of this repeater is such that the pattern differs a little bit between reception and transmission. So when you aim the antenna back and forth for the strongest reception, in most cases, it's not the direction for strongest transmission to the repeater. So it's a little bit of a forward. You aim the antenna a couple of degrees to the right and tell me I've moved 3 degrees to the right, then move it 3 degrees to the left, tell me I've moved 3 degrees to the left, and I'll tell you which one is stronger, if you want to do that. Not required, because as I said, you've only got a couple of percent of hiss in there, Paul. K2RIW.
Understood. I just want to, test it out. It's a different radio. I retired the ICOM, and you might remember many times I would key it up, and you would get this crackling noise, and it would last about 10 seconds, and then it would go away after a period of time. So now that's gone. So here we are. Different radio. Back to you, Dick.
That sounds good, Paul. Once in a while, your S's in that particular microphone get a little bit distorted, but you're good and loud and easy to hear, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, I know. I really gave it a good test with Spark. Spark is the Shorepoint Amateur Radio Club over there in Connecticut. They have a great simplex net. I did quite a bit of testing during the week, so that's really a good way to go. You know, forget about the repeaters. Repeaters are good, but you really want to test something out. Get on simplex. I did all of that. You want to test a new antenna, coax, a new radio, a new amplifier. You know, you get onto a net like that. You're pretty good. Okay, you were talking about the Hubble. Now there's a movement. I talked about it last week to extend the life of the Hubble. They would like to get this new spacecraft that will be flying probably around 2019, a couple of years from now. They're going to use that as a cargo vehicle to the International Space Station. It's called Dream Chaser, and it's well under development by Sierra Nevada Corporation. And that thing looks like a small space shuttle. And it will eventually, after cargo, it's designed to eventually carry people. And once they get that thing developed, they're thinking about using it, thinking about it now, using it for service mission to the Hubble. And that would probably happen maybe in the earlier 2020, 2021, if the Hubble lasts that long. Let me drop it. So that's the story of that. To go on with the NAS, last week we talked about the Dragon being sent up from Launch Complex 39A from Florida, Cape Canaveral. And that was successfully launched. You might remember me telling you that the booster came back. Came back through the clouds, a 15-story booster came through the clouds and landed on another launch complex, used to call Launch Complex 13. SpaceX, the builders of Falcon 9 and the Dragon, which they sent up, also have a lease for Launch Complex 13. They redesigned it for a landing pad, and now they call it Landing Zone 1. And that successfully landed with four legs. It's got fins on the top to guide it through the atmosphere, and everything worked great. And the payload itself was sent up by the second stage, by SpaceX, also the same engines that they use in the booster. They use nine of these Merlin D engines in the booster, and one that's rated for space in a vacuum on the second stage. Successfully sent the Dragon to the space station. And on Wednesday morning, let me drop it.
Paul, are you willing to aim that antenna a couple of degrees to the right, then a couple of degrees to the left, and tell me which? Because I think you could eliminate that hiss. In the past, you haven't had that hiss. How about you, Paul?
Okay, very well. We'll go a little bit to the right, heading towards north. Go ahead. How's that thing?
So far, no change, Paul. Now go a few degrees to the left.
Okay, passing where I was, and now a few degrees to the left. No change?
That's definitely worse. Go back to a few degrees to the right, please.
Okay, we'll try that. And then after this, I'll go to high power.
As long as you're sure that your transmitter won't start tripping out. My transmitter, if I go to high power, it'll work for 15 minutes, and then it trips out with overheating.
Yeah, I know. Mine will do the same thing after probably about half hour, 45 minutes. But my guess, that's probably stronger or no.
I don't know if you change power or direction. Go back to the normal power and move a few more degrees to the right. Let's see what happens.
No, last transmission, I just raised the power, so it's a higher power now. I got one more trick.
Okay, try a few more degrees to the right, because it was getting stronger.
Yeah, that's a few more degrees. I can cure the problem by going in on the other repeater. Stand by.
I think you want to stay here, Paul. You've got it just right. Stay the way you are, please.
Okay, we'll leave it alone until I hear it go beep beep, and then you see the word heat across the screen. Oh no! Now I'll have to go back to lower power. Okay, so nevertheless, the Dragon was going to dock with the space station on Wednesday morning, but it's all pretty much autonomous until they get very close, and then it gets picked up by this 57-foot robotic arm. But it got within, let's call it a half a mile, and the Dragon computers, they can tell where the space station is at all times using GPS, and for some reason they lost that signal. They realized that, the computer itself realized that, as far as it was concerned, it didn't know where the space station was. So they have an actual system on board, automatic, to abort it. And it just aborted it, moved away, and they waved it off for 24 hours. The next day, they straightened it all out, whatever it was. That's the engineers in Hawthorne, California, at the Mission Control for SpaceX. And they straightened it out, and the next day it was successful. They captured it with their 57-foot robot arm, and soon after that, they attached it to the Harmony module, the Harmony node. The Earth-facing side of that node. So they attached it with their 16 bolts, and 4 bolts get made up, and then the other 4 bolts, eventually tighten the whole thing up to create a tight seal, and then they check the vacuum between the vestibule area, and then after that they open the doors. They're able to bring in thousands of pounds of stuff into the ISS clothes, science equipment, and that'll stay like that for a month or so, about 6 weeks, not that long, and they're going to load it up with other stuff. Science racks and things that have to be returned, that will be sent back and landed in the Pacific Ocean near California. And SpaceX has their own ship out there. They'll pick it up and bring it back for the scientists to get a hold of. And they're the only ones that bring anything back from the space station. For now, until this other one, Dream Chaser, gets going. And the earliest flight will probably be the end of 2019 for that. And they'll be able to bring a lot of stuff back. And in fact, they'll be able to land on runways. That's the future of the cargo vehicles. Another cargo vehicle went up, and within 24 hours of the Dragon being first connected to the space station, Russia sent up another Progress vehicle. They launched from Kazakhstan in Baikonur, main facility in Russia for launching things to the space station. In fact, it went off on the same launch facility that Yuri Gagarin went up, first guy to go into orbit. They still use that launch complex, and that was sent to the space station. And they got one more coming up, I believe it's the 22nd of March. That's going to be launched from Cape Canaveral on an Atlas rocket. So that'll be a Cygnus spacecraft built by Orbital ATK. That's the one that's usually launched from Virginia, but they also have a deal when they want to send up extra stuff, more stuff, it's a lot heavier. They got a contract with Boeing and Lockheed. They're the ones that launch the Atlas V rocket. The Atlas V has the capability of launching the Cygnus spacecraft. It's actually called the Enhanced Cygnus spacecraft. It's a much bigger spacecraft than the original one that was first sent up a couple of years ago. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. Just to switch topics for a second. There's another company called Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab is run by a fellow named Peter Beck, another one of these rich guys. And he developed a rocket called the Electron Rocket. Now, you know, don't think of it like I'm going to tell you about an iron rocket or something like that. The Electron Rocket is a rocket that's relatively small in size compared to these other rockets like the Falcon 9 or something like that. The Falcon 9 has the capability of launching, you know, many tons, you know, 10 or 20, actually about 20,000 pounds into orbit. It's done that before with the Intel mission. Not the Intel mission, what was the last one that went up? The one with the 10 satellites. It went up from California a couple of weeks ago. A bunch of communication satellites, 20,000 pounds. But suppose you wanted to send up, you know, say 500 pounds, you know, or 700 pounds to, into any kind of an orbit, not a geosynchronous orbit, but a 300 or 400 mile orbit. And you didn't want to be a second payload, you know. Suppose you wanted your own satellite and you wanted a lot of them. Let me drop it. You know, you would sign up with this Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab's going to launch out of New Zealand. And it looks like probably within a month or maybe 6 weeks, I think, from what I've been reading, you should be able to get the first one off the ground. We've been working on this for many, many years. So this thing is using nine small engines compared to what SpaceX uses with the Falcon 9. But it's a two-stage vehicle. Runs on kerosene, runs on liquid oxygen. But the big difference is it's called a Rutherford engine. It's Rutherford engine. Instead of using the gas reaction from kerosene and oxygen to run the turbo pumps, you need turbo pumps to force all this fuel and oxygen, liquid oxygen, into the engine. Instead of using gas generator system, he's got motors, electric motors, and they're run by lithium ion batteries. And each lithium ion battery is about the size of a soda can, they said. And these lithium ion batteries are going to turn these impellers up to like 100,000 RPM to drive the fuel into the rocket. He's able to cut down on the size, of course, and complexity of it. Let me drop it. And with that, he's going to be able to drive the cost down. So he thinks he could be able to, once he gets rolling, launch one of these rockets, maybe as early as one a week. And he hopes he can eventually drop that down to, you know, even like one every 4 days. So he's got the approval of New Zealand to do this. He doesn't have any air traffic control problems with planes flying overhead. He doesn't have shipping problems. So there's no downrange, you know, constraints that would stop him from launching. And with the thousands and thousands of smaller satellites that are being planned to be sent up, he's going to be in good shape launching from New Zealand. The future plans, eventually, he wants to launch from Alaska and even Cape Canaveral. He's actually listed as an American company. originally himself, Peter Beck, is from New Zealand. So this should be interesting, what's going to be going on with that company. I'll let you know when his first launch goes up. I've seen his launch complex. I posted pictures of it. Built his own launch complex. So we'll see all these guys doing these outrageous things. With companies like OneWeb. OneWeb, they plan on launching thousands of satellites for, they're going to have thousands of KU band satellites flying in space to link the world, the World Wide Web. Different than Iridium, that's what I was trying to think of. That's what NASA launched from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California a couple of weeks ago, successfully. 20,000 pounds. Each satellite was 2,000 pounds. There were 10 of them that they had launched. That's a little different. That's going to be, got a whole bunch of contractors. It's an existing company. But this thing here is going to actually create a system where, the whole world, there's a couple of billion people that can't get on the internet. And if that's successful, they'll be able to do that. That's it for now, Dick. There's other topics, but, I know some people want to talk about the seven planets that were found. Have you heard about that? The Earth-sized planets around one star. Back to you, Dick. KQRIWWS.
Very fine, Paul. I certainly have heard about that star, which is either 39 or 40 light years away from us. It is a red dwarf star. That means it's a little bit bigger than Jupiter, but it's a real star, not just a planet. And it's got seven planets going around it, I believe. And at least two of them, they believe, are in the habitable zone. However, because the star is so much dimmer than our star, so much smaller than our star, it gives you one huge advantage. It has a hell of a lot more life. Our star is good for 10 billion years. You take a star of one-tenth the mass of our sun, for instance, instead of lasting for 10 billion years, it might last for 50 billion years. A smaller star burns its fuel a hell of a lot slower by a cube law. I believe it's a cube law of the mass. So it's going to burn the fuel a lot slower and last a lot longer. Therefore, those planets have a lot longer time to develop life. That's the good news. The bad news, let me drop it. As I've read one report that said all of those seven planets are at a distance from that smaller star, which is the equivalent of being inside of the orbit of Mercury. So they're very close to that star. That gives you another disadvantage. These individual planets are now synchronously locked to each other. They really see each other real strong because they're so close to each other. Second of all, they're getting a very strong gravity hydrodynamic effect between them and the star. Therefore, they estimate that each of those planets have a rotation that is locked with the revolution. Revolution and rotation are locked. So in other words, much like we used to believe that Mercury goes around the sun once every 88 years, and we used to believe that Mercury aims one face at the sun all the time, well, it's a little bit more complicated than that. But these planets, they believe each of these planets aim one face toward the sun all the time. So therefore, the total area on the planet where you've got not too hot and not too cold, on the back side of the planet, it's always going to be dark and cold. On the front side of the planet, it's going to always be hot and high noon, if you know what I mean. So there's a spot somewhere in between where life can easily form, but it's not going to be cycled. You're not going to have tides the same way you do on the Earth with the water that they believe is there. Let me drop it. And when you look at some of the artist's conceptions of what it would be like on one of those planets, you know what it looks like when you see the moon. Can you imagine looking at your other planets, and at least the ones that are closer to you, are bigger than the moon. So probably you're going to see two separate planets closer to you that are bigger than the moon, and they don't sweep across the star, across the sky, because you don't rotate. So it's a bit unusual. However, what they're discovering by way of these, I think it's around 3,500 total exoplanets that have been discovered to date. What they've discovered is that life is strange. Mother Nature is stranger than you could ever imagine. Planets that are big, small, gaseous, lots of liquid, lots of gases, lots of solid, made out of diamond, made out of carbon, whatever. You got all possible combinations. Up until now, most of the planets they discovered are bigger than the Earth for two reasons. One, they believe there are more large planets than small planets. And two, the smaller planets are much harder to detect. So the fact that you haven't found many Earth-sized and smaller is because they're so hard to detect, or there's really less of them. I ain't sure about that one. Let me drop it. So those seven planets probably all aim the same face toward the sun. They could have been there for a very long time because red dwarf stars last a long time. They burn their fuel very slowly. And by the way, the inner planet, I think the outer planet of the seven has an orbital period of a couple of days. The inner one has a couple of hours of orbital period. So by our standards, they move very fast. Their year is very, very short. But that's not necessarily bad. It takes a shift of our thinking as to what life on that planet would be like. You probably have more details on this one, Paul. WS2N. I've forgotten the name of the star itself. It's got a catchy name to it. WS2N, Space Report, K2RIW, the TechNet.
This is WS2N. Yeah, they call it TRAPPIST-1. TRAPPIST. So, they think that three of them have a possibility of having liquid water. And they'll be able to investigate the possible atmospheres of these things. Once James Webb Space Telescope gets up there. So, the planets go in front of the star, and they can, this telescope will be able to read the signature from some of those planets. And I did hear that on National Public Radio. This was a good sized story. It made the internet, of course. Even made some of the news. I would see the scroll of it going by on let's say on Fox News, or they even mentioned it on Channel 12, 12 News, Long Island News. So that was good to see. But they had an interview with some of these people on National Public Radio. And that's with Ira Flatow. That's a very good show. Every Friday called Sci-Fi Friday. It's on out here anyway, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And they actually had two shows, 2 o'clock and 3 o'clock. It was on the 3 o'clock show. And talked to people. And they talked about the James Webb Space Telescope being able to detect the atmospheres. So that's pretty cool. And we'll hear more about this, and we'll get more updates on it. I know with this club anyway, we have an astronomy net, and that's first and third Tuesdays of every month. So Craig does that. Craig, Katie, XK does a great job with that. I'm sure it'll cover that. It covers a lot of other topics as well. But I didn't pay that much attention to it. I concentrate on all the rockets and things. I know Spitzer is the, that was like an infrared telescope that's still up there. It's been up there like 13, 14 years now. And it's trailing behind the Earth. In Earth orbit, drop it. And that's one of the ones that they used to investigate. This is a team out in Belgium got involved. And, so, you know, Spritz was launched from Cape Canaveral with a Delta II rocket many, many years ago. So, you know, one of the four big telescopes. We have Hubble and Compton and Chandra. Four of the big ones. That's going to be followed up by a couple of more telescopes, TESS and WFIRST. That's going to be another big one. And of course, the biggest one is James Webb Space Telescope. So they'll be looking at these planets and many, many more planets in the future. So, very good. One other thing I wanted to talk about was this last Falcon 9 that went up had a computer system on board looking at the GPS. Let me drop it. Yeah, GPS system what they actually wanted to do is if the booster for some reason went off track, either taking off or coming back and landing, you know, you don't want it to, you know, crash into Orlando or someplace or Cocoa Beach. So, or even taking off, you don't want it to, you know, go off track. They spend millions of dollars on radar and all kinds of equipment to, people are stationed in different locations, Bahamas, wherever the, you know, nearby Florida, you know, they have the Merritt Island antennas. You know, there's people that are actually ready to push a button to blow these things up if they go off track. Well, now they have this GPS system on board the Falcon 9. First time they actually used it. They used it in the past, but they call it shadow mode. Just there, but, you know, you had people ready to push the button. This time was the first time out of all the times that they launched. They let it go by itself. It was going to go off track. The computer would say, okay, you know, I'm going off track. I don't want to injure anybody down there. I'm going to blow myself up. And that's now active. In the future, they'll be able to not only cut back on the cost, but launch more quickly, they said, from flight to flight. Apparently they use different systems, you know, for different rockets. An Atlas is going up, they do one thing. If a Falcon 9 is going up, they do another. A Delta rocket, Delta 4 going up, they do something else. So this enables them to have the system on every single rocket that goes up, which is pretty good. They're all also going to use it out of Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, where they also launch. So, you know, time marches on. I brought that up because, you know, I'm talking about all these different rockets. The multitude of rockets that are going to be going up, thousands of ones by this OneWeb company. They have, you know, plans of launching, I think SpaceX has plans of building their own satellites. So, not only are they going to be, there's going to be a lot more satellites, they're still going to be building bigger ones. So you're going to have all these rocket launches going up, I predict, in the next couple of years. You know, right now they're averaging 80, 90 per year. I wouldn't be surprised if you start to see 200, 300, 400 a year nationwide or worldwide. Back to you, Dick. WS to us.
I've done a couple of quick calculations that show you how difficult it is to find exoplanets. Right now, our most productive method being used by the Kepler Space Telescope is to wait until a planet passes in front of that star and creates a little bit of blockage. It's like a mosquito flying in front of your headlight of your car. And if you're doing a very careful measurement, you can tell when the mosquito is there and when he's not there. And because the Earth is around 8,000 miles in diameter and the Sun is around 900,000 miles in diameter, you get 80 parts per million change in brilliance when our Earth is in front of our Sun. If somebody is 10 light years away from us, using a Kepler Space Telescope, looking at the Earth, the amount of change in brilliance of our Sun that he's going to see is 80 parts per million. It's a very small amount to change, so he's got to have some very accurate camera. And because the Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter, and the Sun is 900,000 miles in diameter, and it's 93 million miles between the two, what's the chances of the plane of orbit of our Earth lining up with the Kepler telescope 10 light years away? Let me drop it. If you make a measurement of angle from the center of the Sun toward the Earth, and now you tilt the orbit of the Earth up and down from where it really is, if you tilt it more than 0.28 degrees, the Earth no longer shadows the Sun, if you know what I mean. So 0.28 degrees above or below where it is right now, you're not going to see the Earth passing in front of the Sun. You're not going to detect it. So that's one chance out of something like 320. One chance in 320. In other words, a third of a percent of all the planets out there you can detect in this manner because you've got the right alignment. Only a third of 0.3%. And when you do detect it, the amount of change in light is 80 parts per million. So there's a hell of a lot of exoplanets that are within our field of view, but because of a lack of alignment, we don't see them by this method. It's the best method we got, but we're not going to see them. Let me drop it. And the other method is to look for the wobble of the star. As our Earth goes around that Sun, it tugs on the Sun and wobbles it a little bit once every year. But that method of detection of the wobble only allows you to find the big planets, the ones that really tug on it, to find the Jupiters. You're not going to easily find Pluto's by that method, if you know what I mean. So even though we've got 3,500 exoplanets, with only 0.3% of the ones having the right environment, the right alignment, there's a lot of them out there we're not detecting. And one other subject I want to ask you about, Paul, and that is James Webb Space Telescope, the infrared supersized telescope, is going to go up the end of 2018. Let
me drop it.
And it's going to have the ability to measure the atmospheres of these planets, for instance. Well, let's see what Bernie's got. Bernie's got a question on what you've heard so far. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW.
Hey, Dick. Question on your exoplanet probability equations. Are you saying there's a 1 in 3 chance of the alignment being properly?
1 in 300. 0.3%. 1 chance in 320, I think it is. 1 chance in 320, do you have the right alignment? We think we've got a real good-sized planet. But compared to the size of the Sun, it's very small. And the distance of the Sun, 93 million miles, is really big. So if you look at the possible angles, the tilt of the orbit of our Earth could be tilted so that it's right on the equator of the Sun, so to speak, or it could be tilted so that it's at 90 degrees above the equator. Well, how far can that orbit be tilted and still detected? The answer is 0.28 degrees above or below, out of plus or minus 90 degrees. So now you see how there's one part in 320. One chance in 320, do you have the right alignment? And 80 parts per million is the change in brilliance when you do have the right alignment. K2IO, K2RIW.
Okay, so it's 1 in 320. So now, assuming that the universe has a random distribution that is roughly normal in shape, then we could say that based on those tests, if we find one potential exoplanet, then the probability of there being others is there are probably 320 out there. Do you follow my logic?
Give that man a cigar. You've got it. Every one of the tilts of the orbit are equally likely. So there could be an inclination of orbit compared to us could be 0 degrees, 1 degree, 2 degrees, all the way up to 90 degrees. So, yes, if we've detected one planet, there's really 320 more planets that we did not detect by this method. You've got it, Bernie. Back to you.
Well, the odds are looking pretty good at this point. Anyway, back to the net. I got lost a little bit in your math, and as I showed, I got the wrong number. But 1 in 320 is not bad odds. Thank you, sir. K2YO.
That's using Earth as an example, with 93 million miles and the size of our sun. So for the planets that happen to be closer to their sun, the numbers get better, more favorable. For the planets that are further, like Pluto, a Pluto location planet, let's see, that's 39 astronomical units. Let me round it off to 40. Yeah, I think you could say that the chances of finding Pluto are 40 times lower than your chances of finding the Earth. Not because of the size, but because of the distance from the planet and the angles involved. So 40 times 300 is what? 1,020, something like that. So only one planet and 1,020 at a Pluto distance are you going to find. Back to you, Bernie.
Also, there's a number of factors involved of the size of the sun, the size of their sun, the size of their planet. If we're looking for locations as potential lifeboats, meaning something in the Goldilocks zone, then the map will get much more complex. But we'll leave it at where we are for now tonight.
The good news is you've got 10 to the 11, which is now what? 100 billion. You have 100 billion stars in this solar system. And right now we think almost every single star has got a number of planets. So the total number of planets in this solar system, in this galaxy, is huge. 100 billion. More than 100 billion planets out there. Probably 500 billion. We can only detect a small percentage of them. And we're only interested in the ones that are close to us. The latest issue of Scientific American has this beautiful article of how we're going to send tiny little spaceships out there to Proxima Centauri in order to make measurements. We're going to power them with a laser light beam from the Earth. And we're going to make them move 2/10 of the speed of light. This is a funded project. Some very rich person, unnamed, came along and had funded this project to set up the hardware to launch a whole bunch of these tiny little satellites. These are only a few thousandths of an inch wide for the chip, and I think it's 4 centimeters by 4 centimeters is the solar sail on each chip, and we're going to send them out there to Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri. They're going to make magnetic field measurements, they're going to take pictures, and send the data back to us on a laser beam. The project has started. It's a very long-range project. They've got some very tough problems to solve. But, so we're about to send a very large number of emissaries to Alpha Centauri. Thank you for a comment on this one, Bernie. K2IO, K2IW.
Well, my first thought is it's good to be somebody, whoever that is that's funding it. I think we may be entering, and I'd be curious to get Paul's input on this, but we may be entering the commercial space age, that commercial institutions are now actually developing their own lifting bodies, launch systems, etc. That we could roughly say up until now, if you wanted to get a satellite up there, it may be privately owned, but you got to pay some way to put it up there. You can't put it up there yourself. And we can can talk about the ULA, the Universal Launch Authority, but they're all funded by defense contractors who are funded by the government, so you can't really say that those are truly commercial. And I'm saying something like the Dick and Bernie fan club decide to throw a satellite up there and put it up there with their own lifting body. And I think it's kind of exciting that we're entering that, that we're getting close to that point now where private launching systems may are becoming practical. When you look at SpaceX, SpaceX is a mostly private-generated company, and their launch system is paid for by private funds. And so that's, to me, that's kind of a shift in how the space, or shall we say, a next step in the space programs.
Along the lines of what Bernie just said, the best guy I know to ask this question to is Paul. Paul, I wanted to make a guess that right now, of all the spacecraft launches that have taken place in the last year, could I say that 75% of them were launched by a commercial company and only 25% of them were launched by a nationally owned or military company? Are three-quarters of the current launches being done by a commercial launch firm, WS2N, K2RIW?
Well, your two main commercial launch providers are SpaceX and Orbital ATK. So Orbital ATK has launched Minotaur 5. They've launched the Antares rocket with Cygnus on board. They're getting ready to launch another one down at Cape Canaveral. They're opening up Launch Complex 46. For a Minotaur 4 launch, for a Sentinel spacecraft that's going to be looking at space debris, take an inventory of that. And SpaceX is, well, this was CRS-10, the 10th supply mission to the space station, but they've launched a total of 27 Falcon 9 rockets so far. Now, if you want to include, let me drop this. Boeing and Lockheed combined, they have a deal. They're separate companies, but they do have a deal when it comes to launching the Atlas V rocket, the Delta IV rocket, the Delta II. Now, well, Delta II is not going away, but Delta IV, and mainly the Atlas V. Most often launched. Now, they're actually private companies, and they have a deal between themselves, and they call it ULA, United Launch Alliance, and they're launching a rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base and from Cape Canaveral. And sometimes they launch military, or mostly military or defense projects. So I would say, if you're going to consider those people private, they're really private, but I don't know, it's a gray line. So, to say 80% now, because you have the Ariane 5 that go up quite a bit down in French Guiana out of South America, and they have two other ones that they launched, the Soyuz and the Vega. So they have the light, medium, and heavy, and that's all comes out of our European Space Agency. So I'd say it's the other way around. 80% is still government, but the private ones are coming up. You know, you have SpaceX, you have Orbital ATK, and now you will very soon have Blue Origin. Within a couple of years, you'll see them launching our private rockets out of Cape Canaveral. So, before you know,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Private. Back to you, Dick. A couple of comments about this guy Yuri. I think Mueller. I think he's the Russian that's paying for this interstellar flight. Back to you, Dick.
So I see a definite trend of it becoming more and more commercial as time goes on. That's what I think Bernie was indicating. So the ratio is not 80%, 75% like I was guessing. Maybe it's 20 or 30%, but it's increasing.